So it's my pleasure to welcome for the first time to Many Rivers Books and Tea as a speaker, Meg Beeler, author of this lovely book, Living in the Heart of the Universe, Expanding Your Relationship with Earth and the Cosmos. Meg is an internationally owned shamanic teacher, energy alchemy expert, and founder of Earth Caretakers. She is a lifelong explorer of wholeness and consciousness, has traveled extensively from the high mountains of the Andes and Himalayas to the savannas of Africa and jungles of the Amazon, a graduate of UC Berkeley and Antioch College. Her lifelong inquiry into healing the heart and lifting the spirit drew her into indigenous teachings that would transform her life. Her adopted daughter and husband taught her the power of connection. Working at Apple Computer and later authoring over 20 award-winning technical books taught her to write clear instructions. She grounds herself with organic gardening, walking the land, and perceiving the interrelationships that sustain life. So she has worked with shamanism, meditation, Andean energy healing, and Qigong, which galvanized her to create energy alchemy, her system for changing suffering and blockages into joy through reconnection with nature. She's the founder of Earth Caretakers, as I already mentioned, dedicating bringing our collective dream, bringing to life our collective dream of a more beautiful world, is a chair of the Sonoma Mountain Preservation, and lives on the mountain in the San Francisco Bay Area. So, join me in welcoming Meg Beeler to Many Rivers Books and Tea.
Well, thank you all for coming. It's a pleasure to be here. I'll start by talking a little bit about what brought me to write this small topic book.
Would it be possible for you to speak louder?
Thank you. Yes, please tell me, because my voice tends to drop. So in my early life, I lived in the country and outside of Martinez, and I love nature, and actually nature was much more nurturing for me than humans were, for the most part, not unlike many people. So that got me started, but of course in this culture you're just kind of hanging out in trees and catching pollywogs and whatever. There's no, and the spirit part is separated, so that came a lot later. But one of the motivating issues in my life was a sense of abandonment and struggling a lot with feeling like life was a struggle. So when I was lucky enough to go to the Andes about 25 years ago, I was blown away by the joyfulness that I experienced with everybody. People who lived in stone huts, no electricity at that point, made everything for themselves, very, very hard life. And they were laughing all the time. And I said, how do they do this? I want to know. It really was, I had never experienced anything like that. And I had a wonderful heart-centered teacher, and I kept going back. Even though my daughter was really small, I just, you know, I had that pull. And so there were the people and the joyfulness, and then there was the amazing experience of being in sacred places, you know, many places besides Machu Picchu, where you would just sit down and meditate and you'd have these incredible visions. And I also had never experienced that. Now, some of you probably have experienced that in your travels, but that comes from the ability to tap into deep wisdom comes from the fact that the land is cared for and people are doing ceremony and it's alive. And that aliveness is part of the culture of the Andes that really drew me in, and it's really the one of the sources of this book. And the final thing I want to say is, like probably all of you have experienced, I would go and have these ecstatic journeys, and then I would come home and there was the laundry. And it was very, very challenging, like it is for everybody, to figure out how to, you know, how do you maintain these ecstatic experiences. So I really have spent a lot of time trying to figure that out. And that's a lot of what's in this book. How do you have a regular practice that doesn't take over your life and maintain your connections? So I'm curious, how many of you know how to meditate? Okay, and how many of you have a strong relationship with nature? How many of you combine those two things? Cool. So I'm going to read a little bit from the preface. My encounters with the universe. I began trying to understand the universe when I was 5 years old. God is omnipotent, omnipresent, and infinite, my mother said. I tried to imagine God being everywhere and in everything. I tried to imagine going on forever. What did infinity look like? My young self kept thinking about infinity while I climbed trees, caught pollywogs in the creek, and hiked in the hills with the older kids. I am still curious. You could say that I've spent my life seeking portals into these mysteries. 40 years into my musings about the universe, I was taught an ancient way of healing. By connecting your own heart energy with the energy of the earth and the cosmos, you experience yourself as an integral part of the energetic flow between all living things. A few days after my experience of this healing, I found myself traveling to the stars. From a wooden bench under a vast sky in the southern hemisphere, my astral body floated up into blue-black space. My heart expanded into the cosmos. I began to experience the infinity I had imagined for so long. In that moment, I knew that the world of stars and universes would be endlessly interesting. My life's trajectory changed. Thus began my ongoing journey with the Karo Nation and other Quechua-speaking people of the Andes. I vowed I would return again and again to learn from this culture in which talking to the stars is a normal part of life. My voice okay?
Keep it up.
Okay. Most of my learning has been experiential. When you work with indigenous people who simply live, who do not put in many words around what they experience in their hearts and their bones, you do the same. If you want meaning and mental understanding, you largely have to figure it out for yourself. In bringing forth the beautiful indigenous wisdom I have experienced, I deeply honor those who have shared their worldview with me. I have tried to stay true to the heart of that wisdom while also translating the perceptions and practices I've learned into a flow that will be meaningful for you. Learning to focus my attention and move my energy, release what doesn't serve me, and fill instead with the living energies of the earth and the cosmos changed my life. I hope that learning these tools will change yours too. In guiding you into experiencing your own connection with the living universe, my intent is to help you shift your perception, vision, energy, and story. In this way, we can dream a different world together. So, getting back to the laundry part of life, what kept happening to me is that the heaviness I carried, the heavy heart about the state of the world, the sense of isolation because I was different from most people, that kind of thing, it kept holding me back. I kept finding that I couldn't move forward with these same old patterns and habits and thoughts, and I'm sure most of you have figured that out as well. So, it was actually shamanism that helped me shift a lot of this. Shamanism from the Andes, shamanism from the kind of core shamanism of Michael Harner. And people often say, well, how did you become a shaman? implying that yes, I am a Norma girl from from the East Bay in California, but anyway, and traditionally there are two ways that people receive a calling. One is that their uncle or their grandfather or their mother or somebody in the village is a shaman and they get taught and carry on the tradition. The other way is through illness or some extreme suffering. There are many, many stories of people when they started recording the old shamans who would say, you know, I was sick for 12 years and I didn't want to do it, it's too hard, and I finally gave in and then I got well. That kind of thing. So, in my case, I'd say that it wasn't so much physical illness as heart suffering that led me to it. And of course I had my love of nature and my idealism, but as often happens, the initiations come from spirit, and they came, in my case, also from the land. Not, you know, I had teachers along the way, but it's what's called direct revelation. So I kept coming back to, you know, we've got all this suffering, how do we fix it? And I've had a meditation practice for half of my life, so I was using that, trying to use meditation, but it didn't quite, it's not that it didn't fit the bill, it didn't get me where I wanted to go. So the part about shamanism that I think is really important is it teaches you to see from the heart. It's known as, shamanic vision is known as seeing in the dark, but also known as seeing from the heart. And coming back to the heart was, in vision, is exactly the same thing that I was learning in the Andes, of bringing the earth and the cosmos together in my heart. So, let's read some more. So, this is called Energy at the Heart of the Universe. Long before humans had telescopes with which to view the stars and planets, the living energy universe was perceived as the original subtle womb of the cosmos. Called the Akashic Field in ancient texts, it was the source of everything. Mystics, visionaries, and philosophers of all spiritual persuasions have sought this universal essence throughout human history. What's incredible to understand is that the heart of our universe is a live, vibrating energy. It is a sea of potential, a void, empty but full of possibility, communicating with us and within us across space and time. This vital energy pervades all forms, both animate and inanimate. You can draw on this potential. Your intimate and intricate interconnections within this field will help you expand your relationship with the living energy universe. As Star Goddess, one of my spirit teachers told me about finding this heart, the heart of the universe. When you connect your body and cells to the heart of the universe, your whole energy changes. You are receptive to insights from the cosmic field, wisdom from what some of you call the Akashic Records. Everything changes in what you perceive, how you experience and respond, and how your cells interact with the universe. It is your free will to do this or not. The results arise from the void, all possibility, so they aren't known in advance. You enter into the great mystery, the enigma, the sacred wisdom. So I just want to mention part of shamanic work, all of shamanic work involves working with what some people call power animals, spirit guides, spirit teachers. So they're beings who don't have bodies who come and we make a relationship with them to get and they help us get information. So this comes up a couple of times. We ask questions, and they guide us to finding answers. It's still magical to me after all these years. So we're talking about the universe, but before you can get to the universe, you've got to get to the ground, the nature around you. And so I want to read you this section that's more localized into what we all might experience. You have to spend time outside, observing, listening, being, to sense the environment as your extended body. That's a term that Deepak Chopra uses, the environment as your extended body. Being outside with a specific tree gives you a perceptual or experiential sense of the feeling of its bark, leaves, and shape. Being outside offers you a direct experience of the smell of wet earth, the feel of the wind, and the shifting colors of your favorite lake. The more you are outside, deeply filling yourself with such sensations, the more you become an embodied part of the whole. Imagine you are walking through a forest. Your habit is to look at the trees and enjoy the views. Maybe you identify birds or native plants. Possibly you notice the relationship of a particular species to the environment. Maybe you can even name most plant, animal, insect, and reptile species in the ecosystem. All these skills and habits come from information about the forest. They come from the mind. What if, noticing a bobcat, you slowly, very slowly approach it? What if the bobcat stops and watches you? Suddenly you are paying attention to sound, movement, breath, and footfall. You are shifting out of mind. What if the bobcat lets you approach? Your heart hammers and your body becomes very still. What if the bobcat lets you sit and share the forest, even lets you sing to him? Now you are in your body, your senses. Now you are feeling your connection with the bobcat. You have moved from looking at to being with. You've opened your resonant heart to engage with the living energy of this other being. So in the Andes, relationships like that are perceived as a mutual conversation. It's not just us looking at the bobcat being with the bobcat, but the bobcat is communicating back. And I'm sure most of you have had experiences like this. When I have a hummingbird who comes every afternoon flying around to the flowers behind me and comes right here to say hello every day, sometimes three times in the afternoon. And you know, it's this wonderful gift. So every time that happens, it's a way of expanding our connections and our understanding that we really aren't alone in this universe, that all these creatures are really engaging with us. So our perception is central. When I was separated from my former husband and considering divorce, I lived at the edge of open space woodlands. In my deep sorrow and loss, I was drawn to an ancient oak tree near my cabin, an oak 10 times my age, a being who had seen far more of the world than I had. I found solace in being reminded of my smallness in the scheme of things. It was as if my heart rate lessened as I engaged with this oak every day. A long time before I knew that other people acknowledged and depended on such interaction, I was gifted with this conversation that helped me survive. Establishing a relationship with the natural world is like nurturing one with a human. It takes care, time, intent, and mutual exchange. I read about a man in Arizona who took the same hike in the mountains around Tucson every day for 10 years. His deep familiarity let him know the seasons, the effects of drought on the creatures and plants, and the changes over time. And many cultures have practices like this. A Zen Buddhist monk is assigned a 9-year daily cycle of circumnavigating a mountain. A young Maasai warrior is instructed as part of his initiation to go into the bush with nothing but his spear until he kills a lion. Luckily, lion killing is not part of our culture, and there are other ways to practice deepening by establishing your relationship with place. So part of what's in this book is 84 practices that are simple and potent. They're designed to be, once you get the hang of them, you can just call on them. It's not, you know, they're not so complicated that you have to keep reading about it 100 times or whatever. And my intent was to give people different ways of connecting that would work for them. It's not like you have to do all of them. You just choose one and try it out, and then choose another one and try it out. And some of them will be very familiar to you. It's not, you know, I haven't invented breath. I haven't invented opening your heart by looking at a loved one. Everybody knows about that stuff. But I've tried to incorporate things that you can, once you learn them, you can call on them. Because what I've found and what even the Dalai Lama gets up at 3 a.m. every day to do his practices. As wonderful a person as he is, he still has to do them every day. And that's a big part of whatever spiritual practice you do, is having a consistency so you really keep deepening. So I invite you to just close your eyes and do this one. Do it as I read to you. So you can connect with your heart energy anytime using this practice. Shift your attention to your heart. Breathe in and breathe out through your heart 3 times. Now visualize a place you love. Let yourself imagine the place, see yourself there. Let yourself feel your good feelings as you continue to breathe through your heart. And as you fall into this rhythm, let see yourself sending this heart energy to that place, and drawing the energy of the place back through your heart, so you're making this communication, this back and forth. So before you open your eyes, just take a moment to notice what's going on in your body, whether anything's shifted. I invite you to gently open your eyes. How many of you could instantly visualize a place? And how many of you feel more calm after doing that? I think that's, you know, that's the power of these kinds of things, that when we teach ourselves something that nurtures us and we take care of ourselves, then we can go through life easier. Just So I want to read this little bit from Thich Nhat Hanh about smiling with trees. Buddhist monk, poet, and peace activist Thich Nhat Hanh, exiled from his homeland in Vietnam in 1973, describes dreaming the same dream for a year, seeing a beautiful hill he recalled from his native land, and being prevented by obstacles from climbing it. When he visited a new place and was homesick, he writes, "I knew I could go outside in the backyard or to a park and find a place to practice breathing and smiling under the trees. I know that in our previous lives we were trees, and even in this life we continue to be trees. Without trees, we cannot have people. Therefore, trees and people inter-are. We are trees and air and bushes and clouds. If trees cannot survive, humankind is not going to survive either." Thich Nhat Hanh goes on to describe a doctor in New York City who gives the same prescription to many patients, telling them, quote, "You are sick because you are cut off from Mother Nature. This is the prescription, which you can also use. Each morning, take a bus and go to the tree in the center of the city and practice tree hugging. You hug the tree and you breathe in saying, 'I am with my mother.' And you breathe out saying, 'I am happy.' And you look at the tree so green and smell the bark of the tree so fragrant." So I have some more things to read, but are there questions that people want to ask right now? I'm tired of listening to myself. Yes.
Do you have anything to say about connections with domesticated animals?
They're,
or domesticated plants?
They're really rewarding for many people. So connect with what you can connect with. I mean, we see huge numbers of people rescuing animals and so on, and and that is a powerful connection and a nurturing one. In my training, there was an emphasis on the wild because we're so domesticated. But if that's what you can, that's what a person can do, that's really important. Answer the question.
Yeah. I was struck by your talk about a bobcat, because I had a bobcat come and take one of my chickens once, which was out free ranging, and it just stopped and looked at me, and I said, "Oh no, I'm not going to take your dinner," and I just backed away, and I began to realize there's something in that wildness that's fierce. And that's hard for us to accept. I mean, I have a small farm, and a lot of times the young people come to work on it. They don't want to use force. They think there's something inherently wrong with force.
Hmm.
And so it's how do you see the fierceness of the bobcat and the wildness, and that's in some ways contrary. It's like the domestication that you were talking about that we have.
Well, there, it reminds me of a wonderful story that one of my teachers tells about a peasant woman in the mountains had a pig. And, you know, her pig was her entire wealth. And one day a puma came and started dragging the pig away. And this woman was so determined to keep her pig that she grabbed the front legs of the pig while the puma had the back legs of the pig. And they went back and forth. You know, I guess she was using that force. So the way I heard it, the puma finally gave up. But I think, you know, that's a story about entering into the wildness and finding the balance. And that's what shamanism is all about, finding the balance. I I've had similar experiences where people are, like one day, we have a fox family, and one day early in the morning, there's the fox trotting down the driveway with bird legs hanging out of its mouth. And we know it's going to feed its baby, so it's cool. You know, I love birds a lot, but that's just the natural way, so you just kind of flow with it. I don't know, does that answer?
Yeah.
Anything else right now?
Well, I just want to say, well, I can relate to like your connection to the Southern Hemisphere and the Andes, because I've been really drawn to Australia and Western Australia, and it's like the almost exact opposite of the world. And I've been very connected when I've gone down there to the land and things. And so I just wonder if it's something about the balance, the polar, you know, the polar magnetic force or something between the North and the Southern Hemisphere, and that going between those two hemispheres does something. I don't know what. But the fact that you kind of got, you know, started on this path in the Southern Hemisphere, this is interesting.
That is an interesting question. I don't really know an answer, except that the Carroll people with whom I've worked for a long time in the Andes had no contact with white people. They were so high up in the mountains that the Spanish just didn't touch them. So their culture was very intact until about 60 years ago. And they came out, they had a prophecy that they needed to come out and share what they knew, like many, many indigenous people did around the world. So their prophecy has to do with bringing the eagle and the condor together. The condor is of the south, the eagle is of the north. And my experience of that is that the eagle is the mind, and the condor is the heart. And so this prophecy, and what many, many people making these connections between north and south are doing, are trying to bridge that heart and mind. And it's a really, I mean, I could talk for hours about this topic, but just recently, I had a divination by a friend who's learned Dogara divination from West Africa, and she said, well, there's a break between your head and your heart, and the more I questioned her, the more I realized it was not my personal break. It had to do with the larger culture, and also with the Carroll people with whom I with ancestors. So I've been doing a lot of ceremony around that, and it's been very amazing because you know, we're all suffering from a break between our head and our heart, of course. So that's part of what when I talk in the book about being a bridge, being gifted to learn this stuff, part of my job in the world is to bring it forth and share it with other people so that they can, you know, draw on it in whatever way. And it comes down, you know, you see so many books about love is everything, but it really is. It's just you got to find the way to get to it that works for you. I want to read this one more passage about a bit about alignment and nature initiations. And the thing I want to say about this is before I had this experience, I was in the mountains, and we had this amazing trip where we drove all day from 17,000 feet down to 3,000 feet in the Amazon basin in one day, going through all the ecosystems. Really incredible, on a one-lane road with fights about the trucks going the other way. Anyway, before we did this trip, I had a meditation in which I was dismembered. And dismemberment is it happens to people spontaneously, or you can do it. You're basically pulled apart or disintegrated somehow and put back together. So it's a classic shamanic thing to do. But it was it just sort of happened in this meditation, and I didn't know why it happened, but you'll see in this part of the reading. Coming into alignment creates resonance and flow between you and the universe. An extraordinary experience I had, a lightning initiation, illustrates the power of cosmic alignment. When a sudden downpour becomes a deluge, we hike down fast, feeling the trail turn to mush under our feet. Reaching a palapa, a building with a palm-thatched roof and open sides above the river, exhausted and sopping wet, we light a fire and hover around it, waiting for the storm to end. I stare through sheets of rain at the roiling, muddy, rising river. In my fatigue-altered state, the heat, light, and rain are intense, as if I have entered another dimension, the disintegration my meditation has foretold. Then lightning strikes, shaking the ground under our feet, illuminating everything. It's very close. Americo tells us to welcome it, to reach up our arms and pull it down with the thunder. Three times we reach up and pull in those electrified moments of brilliant flash and rumble. I complete the motions in a daze, barely able to concentrate on lifting my arms. In the Andes, they believe that if the first ray of lightning hits near you and doesn't kill you, it breaks your etheric body into pieces and spreads it out. Like my meditation disintegration, I think. The second ray of lightning brings the etheric body back together. The third ray produces ecstatic contemplation and returns you to an incorruptible unity. Rays of jungle lightning, El Rayo, come from the fire of the cosmos, entering and changing your consciousness of everything. Americo says our lightning experience is alchemical, and that the elements are in charge, producing a karpai or initiation, putting our group into the dimension of lightning. The lightning gives us a deeper experience of interconnectedness. The lightning gives us a deeper experience of the interconnectedness of all beings than I have ever known before. When the rain lets up and the river calms, we quietly pile into the boat and return to the lodge, each in her own sensory world. I retreat to my room. When I'm called to the bonfire and barbecue our host has prepared, even the remnants of my social graces disintegrate. I refuse to join in. I am outside time, promises, and commitments. No mind, just body, the sound of rain battering the tin roof above my room, and lightning in the night. The sensory jungle deluge washes away all vestiges of my shields, defenses, and self-protection. My habitual perceptions disintegrate. I experience the profound silence of the interior light, a heart fullness where everything is in alignment, and my spirit soars. I feel at one with the mystery of the cosmos, without fear. I want to do one more practice because we've been sitting a while. So this is called shaking your energy body to release, and we'll get up and do it in a minute. So everybody should fall asleep. 12 hours after a major earthquake, which rocked our home for several minutes, yet broke only one pot, I still felt a cognitive dissonance. How could we have emerged so intact when the shaking had been so strong? A friend suggested I shake out everything that didn't belong. Following her advice, I stood near the doorway where I'd held on for dear life 12 hours earlier and let myself shake. My body mirrored the quake immediately, shaking just as before, sharp jolts, then rocking and rolling until I came to a standstill. I was so surprised I did it again and realized I was releasing the trauma by re-experiencing the event. Around the world, this is loosely referred to as shaking medicine. As Bradford Keeney writes, shaking is the key to a wild place, the unconscious wilderness, a place that the poet Gary Snyder described as, quote, elegantly self-disciplined, self-regulating, a place without a management plan. This place of wilderness is home to the shamans, Quakers, Gnostics, Taoists, yoginis, anarchists, American Indians, alchemists, Bushmen, Shakers, Sufis, Teilhard de Chardin Catholics, biologists, Druids, Zen Buddhists, and Tibetans. Traditions awed by mysteries that are greater than our capacity to understand. That's the end of the quote. So it's not necessary to save shaking for trauma. You can use it any time to release and move whatever energy does not serve you. It's also quite fun to do in groups. So let's stand up. So with your feet planted, let the shaking begin in your legs and rise up through your torso. Go ahead and do it. Rise up through your torso, arms, and whole body. Raise your arms above your head while you shake, and then lower them. Let the movement take over your body in whatever way it needs to, intending to let it all go. Shake until you naturally come to a stop. Notice whatever arises in your awareness. Thank you. Any comments?
It's refreshing.
Mm-hmm. Very refreshing.
Yes.
I was reading the National Geographic today.
Yeah.
And it was an article on dolphins and the captive ones compared to the non-captive. And non-captive ones spend 80% of their time underneath the water. And the captive ones spend 80% of their time oriented towards the surface because they get everything from human beings.
Hmm.
And it makes me think of us. Not leaning, you know, as much from nature or sustenance that, you know, is available.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're so used to, you know, the procured means of different kinds of food.
Yeah.
There's seafood
there. Thank you, that's what it is. Good example, and if any of you have had the opportunity to swim with dolphins, it's just like this totally thrilling experience because they keep their wildness and they're willing to interact at the same time. They don't interact with everybody. They'll swim around and around and maybe choose, at least in Hawaii, they'll choose maybe one person. And the first time I had great blessing to swim with them, I was so excited I kept forgetting to breathe. So I'd be swimming really fast to keep up with them, and then I'd just be gasping, and they always slow down. to stay with me. It was just, you know, remarkable. And you know, it's like the bobcat, letting ourselves have those gifts of interaction is profound. And probably lots of you have had them, but the more we spend time outside, the more opportunity there is.
I like this, like when I go to Hawaii, my son lives there, so I get to go there pretty frequently, and I love this, I have swum with dolphins, the wild ones that come into this particular beach, Kahina Beach, you know, it's not like going out on the ship and doing all that stuff, they just come in, and they like to tease the people, they'll come in real close, and everybody will jump in the water and swim out, and then they just take off, you know, but I have experienced where one or two of them will go right under me, but I love to snorkel with the little fish.
Yeah.
I think that's so wonderful just to observe those tiny little fish.
My daughter was maybe about 8 years old, and we were in this, it wasn't a very good snorkeling place, but it was near where we were staying, so we would go in this kind of choppy water, and every day we saw this green sea turtle, and we were going to the same beach every day, and it would be hanging around, and turtles don't move very fast or anything, but she and I both had the experience that this turtle consciously turned and looked at us. And engaged with us. And again, it was just like such an incredible blessing. So when you see people, snorkelers, chasing them and scaring them because they want to get a good picture.
So I just want to share this one little thing. Yesterday, I was down by the river in Monte Rio. And there's this one particular beach near where my car is always being repaired. And I go down there and I collect all the garbage that people leave around and go for a little swim and everything. But so there was one piece of garbage that was way back in the bushes. And I'm like, huh, I'm just going to leave that there. And then I thought, no, I have to go get it. I can't leave it there because tide water will come up and it'll take it out. So I went back in those bushes, and there were all these little blue dragonflies, damselflies, yeah, and they were all in there, and I never would have seen them if I hadn't gone, okay, I've got to get that piece of garbage. It was so sweet, it was like my reward.
Definitely. Follow your intuition. Any other questions right now, or comments? Yeah.
I'm very concerned about the relationship between words and nature. And how speech and the conceptual brain removes us and causes that deadly separation.
Right.
Have any of your teachers spoken about our relationship with words? And have you noticed with Native people, do they have a different kind of relationship with words?
Absolutely. I have a section in the book about words, and most cultures have that the language represents the relationship. So the words are different. I'm not thinking of any examples right now, but the language represents the relationship.
Yeah. And language and relationship are the same thing too.
So in terms of the teachers, like I read in the beginning, this is oral teaching. It's indigenous people who are not articulating very much, so you're perceiving much more than you're hearing. But over these 25 years, the importance of perception as opposed to conception is huge. And the perception comes from the heart. The perception comes from when you stop long enough to engage with the bobcat or the damselflies. And I've learned a really important lesson. I have house on the side of the mountain in Oak Woodland. There's a lot of windows. And I was standing one day, I was looking out the windows, thinking, oh, how pretty it is. And I walked outside, looking at the exact same view, and my whole energy changed. And I realized at that moment the huge difference between looking at and being in. And a lot of the practices in this book are designed to help you engage experientially and perceive rather than have words around it.
Well, that's there is a language that talks about, and there is a language where that thing that you in the other language talk about, where that thing speaks itself.
Mm.
And that's where speech for me becomes healing. And it's not separating me anymore,
mm-hmm.
but it's holding me in that relationship that I want.
Mm.
I think that's all I can say.
Okay.
Right now.
Well, it's a wonderful inquiry, and it's hard to talk about because we're constrained. But this is not an example of nature, but I don't know, I was in college or something, and everybody was, you know, people would say, I love you, and it felt really flat to me. I didn't know what love was. I wanted to love, but, you know. Then I learned about the word agape, which is a Greek word, and it had a huger, it just embraces so much more than our narrow word of love, and that started tuning me in. I mean, I'm sure others of you could think of better examples, but our language definitely constrains us. So that's why I'm such a... I put so much emphasis on experience. Because it's... You know, getting it in your mind doesn't do it. We all know that. We can learn... We can read a bazillion books on this and that, and maybe we can remember them. I can't, but... it just doesn't move anything. It's the experience that moves them.
Nature has a mind. Mm. Nature is a mind in itself.
And we're nature.
Yes.
And so we can teach ourselves to experience ourselves as being in. Yes.
I have a question about you mentioned you raised a daughter, and while you were studying shamanism and practicing, you know, this experiential way of being in nature. And I don't know how old she is now, but I'm just curious about how that has informed her life and if she's been able to hold on to that or if there's been some, you know, just, yeah.
Oh, well, that's an interesting one because she's adopted, so... We don't have natural proclivities in the same directions, much as I would have liked that to be true. So it's very interesting to me now, she's 31, that when she comes home, she'll talk about, she saw the fox down the road, or she'll hang out with the trees. And she got some of that engagement, even though after she was about six, she stopped liking to hike, as many kids do. But what it did for me is it made a huge difference when we had just, she was suffering, we were all suffering in our family. It was really, really a struggle. And what kept me going was these connections that I could open my heart with. And learning to open my heart and be present eventually made a huge difference in her and my relationship. Because I was learning to not be attached to, you know, this, that, or the other image. Like you learn in nature. You're not attached to what the bobcat does. You're just hanging out and watching it, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that directly answers your question, but...
Oh, that's a great answer.
Yeah.
Do you think some people have, like, a natural proclivity toward connecting with nature and having that ability to open their heart. And I hike with different friends and stuff, and you know, I try to kind of like, okay, listen to that raven, you know, what's that raven saying today? And they just don't get it. They're like, oh, well, raven means this, and you know, that's, and they're always going kind of like on the, you know, from the past. It's you know, and I'm a very right brain person, so I'm thinking, you know, maybe that's just because I just naturally do that, you know.
Well, what do you think? Do you think it's their training or their propensity?
Yeah, I don't know. That's what
I mean. Certainly, people can be trained, and that's what we,
yeah,
when we work with kids to connect them with nature, we're intentionally training them to perceive in different ways and, you know, see what's out there and listen. You know, I work a lot with teaching people how to what direct revelation is, and that's a term that's used where you stop and the raven does something and you interpret it. You know, it's metaphorical message, and your metaphorical message might be different than my metaphorical message, which is fine because it's all about our personal. My sense is that it's more a cultural training and habit. Yeah, most people just hike, or I'm going to go 5 miles, or I'm going to go 73 miles, or whatever, and don't, and there's some propensity to, huh?
Yeah. You got your Fitbit on,
yeah,
it's all about how many steps, and, you know. Or you got your cell phone.
Or it's about, you know, my book says this about the crystal.
Yeah.
Rather than, what does the crystal say?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's the difference between mind, information, and heart.
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm, I guess in answer to your question, what's important is for me, is to keep trying to model a certain behavior and to forgive the other people who want to talk about what they read about Raven in a book or whatever. So, oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, I want to thank you first of all for writing such a clearly written book that's really well organized.
Thank you.
It feels to my left and the right hemisphere of the brain, which is very rare. I think this is probably the best, the book is the best one I've found. For me, as an introduction and overview of the Indian philosophy and system. So
thank you.
But I found something that I can relate to. My question is about technology and its relationship with nature. You know, we're gaining tremendous powers with brain-generated technologies that can really transform the world. And now I see these technologies being focused on trying to transform the human person, which could be a good idea, but it's bringing in a lot of, you know, I think ego motivations. And I was wondering, in the Andean system, one could also get tremendous powers to influence nature. And I'm wondering, is there a vision in the Andean system of what the human potential and direct evolutionary direction is, that can sort of be a guide towards this human, apparently human, deep yearning for you know, transformation and transcendence?
I'd say the vision is of union. The old quest, and a quest that to me is kind of it's the center of my quest. Because when I'm in union, and union has different parts, it has alignment and resonance and all these different things, but when I'm in union with a person or a tree or an ecosystem, there's incredible balance. And, you know, we're moving with grace in that context. And that I have to confess that I'm a Luddite. I don't personally believe, and I had to work in Silicon Valley for 20 years, so that was that was a challenge. I don't believe that technology can solve our problems. you know, I don't know how many of you read, there was an article last week about this huge aquifer in the Central Valley that they found. Enormous. And I'm reading this article and I'm thinking, we really need to get on this, because you can feel in the article the greed for the water.
Yeah.
Oh, we can get the water, you know. Oh, we can pump, you know, 1,000 feet deep or whatever. And it's an opportunity to try to shift things early on rather than going along with. But yeah, it's going to be, you know, it's a constant struggle, as we used to say.
Union is in the Eastern, East Asian philosophies. Union is sort of put forth, as you said, as a way to, as a vision of transcendence, to sort of overcome the illusion of separation. But there are some that say once union is achieved, that's just the beginning. That's sort of getting back to the natural state, but then there's something that comes out of that union, the transformation.
Mm.
And I'm wondering if there's something in the Andean philosophy that would be helpful to put that out there as an alternative to people that are talking about implanting chips in the brain to increase the brain capacity and all these other ideas that are coming from, you know, ego brain and greed,
yeah,
too.
Well, there's one of the well-known Andean teachers is Juan Nunez del Prado, and he and my teacher Americo Yabar and Alberto Villoldo,
mm-hmm,
all studied with the same Carol people and the same man in the Sacred Valley at the same time,
mm-hmm,
and they each took away a different aspect of the teachings. Juan Nunez del Prado has a linear conception of it that is amazing, because my teacher has this totally mystical, you know, nothing was explained, very experiential. And Alberto Villoldo had the kind of marketing aspect of it and brought it out to a lot of people. But if you look up, I can't think of the names of the books right now, but there are some people who wrote books who work with him, and they describe, there's a whole ceremony process that's part of the of men and women coming together in a certain ruin, Reichi, I think. I haven't done this, so anyway, you could find more about that vision. I don't know if that would answer your
the Erica process. The Yodo has, there was somebody else, I'm trying to think of his name, who was associated with him.
Erica Princess?
Arika? A-R-I-C-A.
Uh-huh. I don't know anything about that.
It was not the Yodo, but it was somebody else who was, had worked with
Oscar
him.
Oscar Chavez?
Maybe. That's what I mean.
Well, the energy work that's in this book is, you know, it's based on the Andean conception. Is that, or perception, is that everything is alive. The mountain is alive, the stone is alive, the yama is alive, etc. And we're in relationship with everything. So being in relationship, a lot of the practices that I learned that work really well for me have to do with releasing energy. This isn't a mental thing. I'm not thinking what I'm releasing. I'm just gonna, you know, I feel kind of heavy or dense or something, and I'm going to release it to the earth or the air or the water or fire and draw in the energy of those elements. Very direct exchange of energy. And it's transformative because it takes you so much out of the mind, and you're not going, oh, I'm depressed, oh, I'm lonely, oh, I'm yada yada. You're not going zing, zing, zing like this. You're just saying, this is something I don't need, I'm going to let it go. I'm going to let it go, and I'm going to take in something light, lighter. So they have this whole heavy energy, dense energy, and lighter, more refined energy. And it's always about an exchange. And I, you know, maybe that addresses the other question too. And people have different ways of, you know, teaching about that.
Do you work with mentors on the other side in the shamanistic realms?
Well, I work with power animals and teachers, yes. a lot.
And teachers in particular.
Well, I don't do the archangels. Everybody has their own power animals and teachers, and they have names. And in my work, the relationship with them is essential. You don't get them and, you know, ignore them. You say hello to them every day. You engage with them. And you don't always have a chance to hear everything they have to say. It's frustrating because, you know, you have to listen all day long. You want to say anything about this?
Just that there's such a close connection, my helpers and my power animals that I work with. I feel them around me and with me all the time. Whether I'm journeying to them and going in an altered state or just walking in the world, they're always present.
Yeah, ditto for me.
Yeah. So it's like it's just the energy around us.
And they'll, you know, different ones will appear for different issues. You know, some like this has been really interesting. About, I don't know, 6 or 8 years ago, I was called to do this project with star beings, and I didn't know anything about star beings, but I just sort of did the seat of the pants approach and kept asking what I was supposed to do. So I did a lot of ceremony, and I got other people involved in ceremony on all the mountains around the bay and in the Himalayas and various other places. So recently, the star beings have showed up, and they're around me all the time, and it's wonderful. But you know, 8 years later, I mean, maybe they were there and I wasn't perceiving them. I'm not sure, and it's probably to do with the book. But it's very interesting how that happens. There was a passage I wanted to read about a relationship with a mountain, but I think we're too burned out to do that. So I just want to read two concluding things. And we can talk some more, but I don't want to make people stay forever. So no matter what challenges you face, you can always view them through a different lens. This book's lens is energy. To help you dream your own new dream, this book guides you in exploring simple patterns and practices for changing energy. But I was just talking about the heavy and the light. The choices you have with your attention and energy are illustrated by an old Apache story. A grandfather is teaching his grandson about life. "A fight is going on inside me," he says. "It is a terrible fight between two wolves. One wolf is angry, arrogant, resentful, and judgmental. The other wolf is kind, compassionate, and generous." Grandfather says, "Sometimes it is hard to live with these two wolves inside me, for both try to dominate my spirit. The same happens for you and everyone." The grandson thinks for a minute and then asks, "Who will win?" His grandfather replies, "The wolf you feed." If you feed the wolf of compassion and kindness, your energy moves in that direction. If you focus your attention on being open-hearted, your energy moves in that direction. Conversely, if you focus on the negative or heavy aspects of your experience, in your behavior, in the stories you tell, or the chatter in your mind, your energy remains stuck there. Okay, so here's one of my teachers. Maybe this will answer your question. "As I was writing this book, my spirit guide Apuchin told me," Apuchin is the name for Condor, "you humans are going to have to relearn and reinvigorate your connections with each other and all other living beings for your survival. You spend way too much time feeling sorry for yourselves and spinning your wheels with worry. Remember that you receive wisdom, knowing, information, and guidance through yourselves, through your experience, and through your bodies. You are connected with the living energy of all, including the unseen. Think of this book as your reference for engaging with the energy of the world. As you explore the path of energy practices, you will learn to perceive yourself as a connected, radiant being who moves and acts from your internal authority. You will learn to see with your heart, because ancient indigenous and shamanic peoples knew this, and their wisdom is reflected here. You can learn from their ways. You will move away from isolation and feed your profound interconnection with all beings as you learn to sense and see living energy around you and within you. You will shift your perception with practices of alignment, reciprocity, receptivity, and intent. You will begin to experience unity consciousness, an embodied feeling of oneness, finding your own heart's resonance with the heart of the universe. So you've been a totally wonderful audience, and I'm happy to obviously to sign books and to stay talking, and if you didn't buy your book, you can get one from the desk. And I also invite you, if you feel inspired, some of your writers in this room I know, to, you know, to write a review or put it in your blog or whatever. Just say what you want to say. I very much appreciate that. Any last questions? We good? Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, wait. We have more now.
Just another brief announcement or two. We have a donation bowl over on the counter. We encourage you to contribute to it. We share those contents with our speakers and retain half to maintain this space for further such events. Of course, the books are over here for you to take a look at. And thank you so much for coming to Many Rivers tonight.